हरिः ॐ सहना भवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
ओके यू गॉट अप टू व्हेयर हाउ फार डिड वी गेट लास्ट टाइम
One point one.
Okay, the secondary creation. Okay, so that's on 15. Okay. Okay, so then the primary creation is understanding, the essential element to understand there is how everything in its blueprint form has been created already by Krishna. Right? Because sometimes there's a confusion here between the primary and secondary. Because you read it, it's already been seen that you know, all everything's been created, and then Brahma comes along and creates it again. So then, generally, it's not seen the difference. It means Krishna created the concept of it, how it's going to function, everything about it, how it's just going to work. Then Brahma manifests it. Does that make some sense? As far as life forms go. It means all the elements are created. That's already there, so Brahma doesn't even have to bother with that. All the natures of the living entities, then that's already been created by Krishna. So now Brahma simply manifests the living entities that create the other living entities, that already their natures are manifest. Does that make some sense? So this is the difference between the primary and secondary. It means the first, all the building blocks are made, and the inherent nature of everything. Of the living entities. The second is the living entities are manifested according to Krishna's already pre-planned creation. Yes?
When you mean inherent nature, that means the original mode of Buddha is special?
No, it means the modes are already created, but then the particular combination of modes that a particular living entity has. Right? You know, you take a yaksha, they have an inherent nature. Like that. You take a Rakshasa, they have an inherent nature. Gandharva, a human. And of humans, Brahmins have a nature, Kshatriyas a nature, Vaishya, Shudra a nature. You know, trees, plants have a nature. You know, the reptiles have a nature. The aquatics have a nature. The birds have a nature. So they all have that. And then within that, there are fine divisions. All birds basically have the same nature. But within that, there's some fine division. You know, just like all dogs have the same nature. Within that, some are more ferocious, some are more timid, some are very confident and very friendly, some are not at all, they're very mental. So those are also inherent in that species. Then you have the particular individual. You know? But the inherent nature of how it will act, that's fixed. You know? That's already fixed by Krishna. So that's the difference between the two. Also, the secondary creation includes recreation. Right, it has to be created again. It means in the day of Brahma, it'll be destroyed, and then again created again. So every day of Brahma, there's a recreation. Like that. And even within that, the Manvantaras is a recreation. Right? It means at the end of a Mahayuga, then there's a destruction up to the earth planet.
That's the Mahapralaya.
It's not Maha. It's a pralaya, but it's only up to the earth planet. Earth on down, the first seven planetary systems. At the end of Manu, which is 71 cycles of the Mahayugas, then Indra, Manu, you know, all the Dick Pauls, you know, who's the Kuvera, who's the Yamaraj, who's the Varuna, who's the Agni, you know, all of them change. So all the officers of the universe change at that time. So then there's a destruction up to the heavenly planets. But Maharjana Tapasatya, there's no destruction. Right? Then at the end of the day of Brahma, then it's a destruction up to Satyaloka. Everything below Satyaloka is destroyed. Right? So it's constantly being created and destroyed, created and destroyed. So that's Visarga, that's the second. And that's why it's the secondary, because it's made and destroyed, made and destroyed. So what was described before was the primary, where Krishna breathes out and he creates all the elements. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's why we see is, we will discuss the psychology of something. Means we will look at something and we will first look at, okay, what is the situation? Right? So that's generally pretty common. Most people can catch that, but some people, even that's a little subtle. Because they're so, what do you call it? Subjective. They only see their angle. They don't see that it's a field. Right? They are in a field of action, so they have their view perception of the field, but the field has so many aspects. So even that sometimes is hard for people to catch. And that's the grossest, is the field. Then within that field, how people will act, that's the psychology. Right? So therefore, based on inherent nature, they will act. Then you have more, so that's still dealing with the secondary creation. Then more subtle than that, you go back to what's created from the primary creation. What is the actual, you know, inherent nature of that kind of species? What is the modes of nature that are at work to create that? You know? How do all these, you know, different things of the mind, the intelligence, the ego, and the platform of consciousness and soul, how do they connect together? Right? So that's going back to the primary creation. So then that's taking it more subtle. Then you have to get it back to Krishna. Then you go back to the origin. When you can take it through that far, then you've gotten all the way to Krishna. Right? So that's the idea that we're trying to get to. Now, if you can just go from where you are now to Krishna, that's nice. But in doing that, it has to practically apply. And if not, how much you have to apply of that, then you apply depending upon one's nature. Someone has to have more of understand the emotions behind it. So the psychology is more important. Someone else, they have to understand the other more subtle metaphysics of it. What's the intellectual, these kind of things of it. You know, some people don't bother with that. It's just, well, what does Krishna say? You know, and he says, like, that is good enough. They'll do it. They don't have to be convinced otherwise. Does that make sense? So that's the whole point, is this, whether you're dealing with the karma aspect, the jnana aspect, or the bhakti aspect. It means it's all for us, because we're seeing it in relationship to Krishna. It's all devotional service. What we see is that the Gita, the last chapters of Gita, are all about this metaphysics. How the modes of nature work. What are the divine and demoniac natures? Right? The modes of nature is more subtle. The divine and demoniac means you're coming down into application of those modes. Does that make some sense? So in other words, you're dealing with all these different aspects of the creation. The idea is to fold it all the way back until you get to Krishna. Once you get back to there, then it becomes very, very nice. Right? If you stop in between, it's not far enough. Right? You know, but if it's connected to Krishna, you know, even if you don't understand in between, then it's successful, because Krishna's there. But if we do all the nice things in between, but don't get it to Krishna, then it's something less, it's something short. Does that make some sense? So, this is the whole point in these two discussions, right, up to the point of the law, is understanding how the creation is made, and how things function in the creation, right? So that's this whole chapter. Means it goes into the next chapter. Means up to page 22. It is actually the whole, what is the creation, and therefore what is the law based on that, right? In other words, people have an inherent nature to enjoy and to control separately from Krishna. what that nature is, then is described by the creation. How that nature should be engaged properly so it can be connected to the Lord's service, that's the law. Right? Does that make some sense? Mm-hmm. So that's what we're trying to get at by this whole first section. The overview of the whole section is, what is the created inherent nature? Right? And how does that, then, is that governed by the law so it can be engaged in the Lord's service? Right. So that's like an overview of the whole section. Then within that, that has two parts. There are, let's say, three parts. It has the primary creation, which is all the inherent elements that everything is based upon. The secondary creation is putting those together, putting together the building blocks and making the living entities. And then the third part is the law itself, the definition of the law, by which the living entities are supposed to function. Does that make some sense? Yeah. So that's what we're trying to get at. Okay, so now is the secondary creation. Okay. Brahma's appearance and duties of creation. So this is talking now about, Brahma's talking about Mahavishnu. Dividing his own body, the Lord became half male and half female, and with that female he produced Virag. O most holy amongst the twice born, know me, whom that male, Virag, himself produced, to be the creator of this whole world, having performed austerities. Right? In other words, the Lord is half male and half female, and then from that, then he creates. Right? You must have seen this picture of, sometimes there's a picture you see of Lord Shiva, who's half Shiva, half Parvati. Mm-hmm. Seen that? Right down the middle? Mm-hmm. Like that. So this is the principle. Because the creation of within the world of the species is done through Shiva and Parvati. Right? In other words, the internal potency transforms into the external, and Krishna transforms into Shiva. Right? So even though Vishnu enters everything, it's his potency that does everything, still the medium for doing that is Shiva. Right? Because you're dealing with ignorance. Because Krishna technically doesn't touch the material energy. He touches it through Shiva. But he's the one that's making it happen. So that's why we don't make so much distinction between Krishna and Shiva. Right? Like Advaitacharya. He's known as Mahavishnu, he's known as Sadashiva. Because on that platform, then there's no difference. It's just a mood difference. One is he doesn't deal with material energy, the other he does. Right? In other words, he gives shelter to the material energy. But the actual interaction of pastimes with it, that is Shambhu. That's Shiva that we know of. But when you're dealing above that, Sadashiv, then it's actually just another mood of Narayan. Right? Just like when Krishna's in the mood of austerities, he takes the form of Naranarayan Rishi. Right? Mm-hmm. When he's in the mood of governance, then he takes the mood of Ramachandra or Prithu. When he's in the mood of literature, he takes Vyasadeva. So when he's in the mood of dealing with the material energy, then he takes the mood of Shiva. Does that make some sense? Like that. So therefore there's a difference between Sadashiva and Shambhu. Right? Or Rudra. Like that. Because he actually consorts with her. Krishna never consorts with material energy. Like that. So in here, then that principle is that when he enters the universe, he enters as time and with ego. So time combined with ego, he's in the mood of Shiva. Even though he's Vishnu, Garbhodakshaya Vishnu is Vishnu, but there's a mood of the Shiva element to it because he's dealing with material energy. It's a very subtle point. Is Vishnu in that mood? Right? It means he's the creator, he's the maintainer, he's the destroyer. Right? That's the Purusha avatar. It means in Vaikuntha, you don't have that mood. He's just God. Does that make sense? Because there is no creation, there is no destruction. So he's just God. But in the material world, then the Purusha avatars, they're God, but they have a different mood of that they are creator, maintainer, and destroyer. Spiritual world's only maintainer. But here you have creator and destroyer. So besides his mood as Vishnu, he has the mood of Hiranyagarbha and of Sadashiv. Right? So one is his left arm, one is his right arm. Does that make some sense? Yeah, so creation is left arm. That's Hiranyagarbha. Right arm is Shiva. Because that's the basis. Like that. So that's the mood. This is described in Brahma Samhita. Then, taking that mood of Shiva, he enters, because it's ignorance. Dealing with material energy is ignorance. So therefore, he's creating that ignorance for everybody. Within that, then you have his mood as Vishnu, or he expands as, you know, Brahma is born, or that's if he's expanded as Shiva. Does that make sense? So Krishna, in the mood of Shambhu, enters into the material world, as Garbhodaksha Vishnu. Then he expands as Brahma, as we know, and Shiva, as we know, the demigods. Right? Because Sadashiva is not a demigod. He's outside the material creation. But with that mood, he enters. Right? Does that make some sense? The subtle thing, it's just rasa. It's just the mood difference. Therefore, everything in the material world is based on ignorance. So if you remove ignorance, you remove the material conception. That's the key. You're trying to get at ignorance. You remove that ignorance and this whole thing of time and space, you're not in the material world anymore. Then you're on the transcendental path. Does that make sense? So here, then that means is in that mood, he becomes half male, half female. So from that, then is produced virag. And then virag produced Brahma. And that's at least according to here, if this translation is correct. Then I, means Brahma, desiring to produce created beings, perform very difficult austerities, and thereby called into existence 10 great sages, lords of created beings. Right, these are Brahma's sons. They created 7 other Manus, possessing great brilliancy, gods and classes of gods, and great sages of measureless power. Right, because one of the Manus was Swayambhuva. He's one of the ten sons, right? So then, these sons, then they, because they're Prajapatis, they created others. And then from them came the other Manus. That's why Manus brought out, because this is the laws of mankind, so that comes down to Manu. So the emphasis here is on Manu rather than on another particular person, rather than Narad Muni or like that. Does that make some sense? The whole idea is that Prajapatis, and of that, Manu. So for us, Manu is important. Because he is the one that then instructs mankind. Therefore, Manu Samhita. Right? So you're seeing the line of Manus. It means Krishna is the original Manu. Right? Then Brahma as Manu. And then Swayambhuva Manu is Manu. And then the other 6 Manus who follow him. Because that's where this knowledge is handed down. Does that make some sense? So the whole idea is this book is presenting the line of thought from the viewpoint of the Manu. Right? Because it's Dharma Shastra. Okay. The various conditions in this always terrible and constantly changing circle of births and deaths to which created beings are subject are stated to begin with that of Brahman, and to end with immovable creatures. Okay, so now his whole—that was whole Brahma's creation was all done there. In other words, he starts the Manus, his sons, and they bring into the Prajapatis, and then after that, then everything else is done. Right. So from Brahma right down, then disillusion and recreation. When he whose power is incomprehensible had thus produced the universe in men, he disappeared in himself, repeatedly suppressing one period by means of another. when that divine one awakes, then this world stirs. And when he slumbers tranquilly, then the universe sinks to sleep. Thus he, the imperishable one, by alternately waking and slumbering, incessantly revives and destroys this whole movable and immovable creation. Right? So when he's awake, it's happening, and when he's asleep, it's asleep. So when he moves, it moves, and when he sleeps, it sleeps. So that's, we can understand he's the Lord. So Brahma's still saying, even though I've created this, still it's in the hands of the Lord. Right? So that's the point. So in other words, we see here, in this 1-1, 1-2-1, then the whole point being made there is then Brahma is making making the secondary creation, and he's created all the classes of life. Right? From him, all classes of life are coming. Of that, for us, the Namanas are prominent. So that's one point. And the other point is that everybody's subject to the cycle of birth and death, from Brahma to the immovable living entities. Right? Therefore, this laws of Manu are important for us. As everyone is subject to birth and death, therefore the laws of Manu can help us how to engage our life in the Lord's service so we can get out of the cycle of birth and death. Right? Does that make sense? So that's what's here. Now this disillusion and recreation. Then we see that whole point is that it all depends upon Vishnu. Even though Brahma's created it, manifested it, still, it still depends upon Lord Vishnu. When he awakens, this whole primary and secondary creation happens. And when he sleeps, it all disappears. Right? Brahma, the living, everybody, they all go to sleep. And then when he's awake, then they're all awake. Does that make sense? Like that. Also, we have the other, that's on the bigger scale, and the smaller scale is when Kirodakshaya Vishnu sleeps, or Garbhodakshaya Vishnu sleeps, then that night, then all the universe sleeps. So there's destruction. Right? And then when he awakens, again it manifests, then Brahma's creation manifests. So you can see it on two levels. Either on the bigger, on Karanadakshaya Vishnu, when he breathes out or breathes in, the universe manifests or not. People are awake or asleep. Then within it, when the Purusha avatars in the universe are awake or asleep, then the universe functions or not. Right? So then it's just a matter when he sleeps, then all that's left is the residence of Brahmaloka. You have your daily, but then you have at the end. So he functions on all these levels. Like you see, the thousand-headed Purusha, which is Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, he stays with Lord Brahma. So when he sleeps, it's destroyed everything below Satyaloka. And when Vamanadeva, he lives with Indra. Right? So when he sleeps, then everything below Indra is destroyed. Does that make some sense? So like that. So all depends upon the Lord's waking and sleeping. So that's the point here. Is that in any case, it still is all fully dependent upon the Lord, even though Brahma is the one that's manifesting it. Then 1, 2, 3, Lord Vishnu is the origin of the sacred law. But he, having composed these institutes of the sacred law, himself taught them according to the rule to me alone in the beginning. Next I taught them to Mrichi and the other sages. Bhrigu here will fully recite to you these institutes, for that sage learned the whole in its entirety from me. Okay, so now here's the final point of this whole section of just the creation and recreation here, the overall, is that the law has been created by Krishna. That's very, very important. That's why we don't deal with it cheaply. The law has been created by him. So if we have a higher law created by Krishna, then the lower law is not so important, right? The primary rule must always be followed. The secondary rule may or may not be followed. Right? That's the rule. So then, like you have yama and niyama, right? So that's the yama is the primary, niyama is the secondary. So that has to be followed. So if you have a higher rule, you means always remember Krishna, never forget. So if you have some smaller rule and you're already remembering Krishna, then it doesn't matter. But in any case, you have to be following the rules of God. Right? Whether it's based on the tattva, in knowledge, or it's based on the rasa, on spontaneity. In any case, it still has to be conform with what Krishna said has to happen. Right? So that's the point being made here, is God created these institutes, and so therefore, then we cannot doubt them. We can't just say, oh, we don't bother with that. That's not the way it works. We don't bother if we have a higher rule. If we're following a higher rule, it's just like if you follow the rule Trinada Pisanichana, Turopisha Hishnuna, Amarina Manadena, Kirtanya Sadahari. You follow that perfectly in every aspect of your life, every dealing with anything animate or inanimate, then you don't have to follow one other rule as far as the Dharma Shastras go. Because you will perfectly do everything. Right? But if you're not following that in absolutely everything, then you need to supplement. Yes. Oh, no. Yeah, power and authority, but unless it is controlled. He has to be humble to his advisors and his seniors. He needs to come across that. That's dealt with in the seventh chapter, is that the king has to surround himself with Brahmins. You know? It means he has his ministers, but besides them, he has to have them. They may be elderly, but he has to have other elderly Brahmins that he himself is still studying scriptures from. And he must learn from them humility. Even if he's humble, he still should practice learning from them humility. Because otherwise, where will the people get their humility from? Right? It's just like this. The child, if the parent does not have a mood of submission towards their authorities, that child will never be submissive to his parents. So generally you'll see that. You'll see children who have trouble with their parents because of authority difficulties, you'll generally see is because their parents have trouble with their authorities. That's a very easy thing. That's the difficulty with actually... We say, you know, Krishna is very simple, we don't get into all these things, but the blunt truth is sometimes too much too. And so we'd like to distract ourselves with other aspects. But you'll generally find those whose children have problem with authorities because their parents have problem with authorities. It's very, very simple. Those children have no problem with authorities because their parents have no problem with authorities. They're automatically humble. So that mood comes off to their children. So that's the principle. So if he's not tolerant, see, so the point is what is the natural thing for someone untrained? If they have power, then do they tolerate anything that goes on around them, or they just use their power? They just show their power. Something goes wrong the way they don't like it, they show their power or not? Yes, but that means then, but what we're talking about here with God's law means then you have to be tolerant, because maybe they don't personally like it, but maybe it's in line with God's law. Okay, so now the person who is not tolerant, even if it's in line with God's law, but he doesn't like it, what's he going to do? He's going to be intolerant. So without good qualities, you cannot have authority. That's the whole thing. It's just like this. It seems contradictory. You won't have a good grihastha unless you have sense control. Because they're dealing with the senses. If they're not controlled in that, then they can't function with them. Right? This is the whole difficulty. Is that God is everything. So that means everything is happening at once. Perfectly. Right? So all contradictions are happening at the same time in harmony, if you follow God's direction. So you have somebody who their field is sense gratification. But you can only deal in that field to the degree that your sense controlled. The less your sense controlled, the less you can get out of the senses. The more your sense controlled, the more you get out of the senses. Right? Just like they say, you have somebody who, you know, will eat anything. I mean, it doesn't matter. Well cooked, not well cooked. Doesn't matter what time of the day, season, anything. Doesn't have to match anything else. So will they get much out of their senses? You know what I'm saying? No. They get something, because when the sense touches the sense object, of course there's going to be some sensation. But now you take a connoisseur, who they will only eat certain things at certain times, cooked properly, you know, everything has to be appropriate. So that means that takes great self-control to do that. But now what do they get from the senses? More or less than the person who will just eat anything at any time. So that's the point. Is that it's all these things that are seem to be contradictory. So generally we think of it, the brahmacharis, the vanaprastha sannyas, they're sense control, and the grihasthas are just, you know, complete sensual madmen. It doesn't matter, they can do any old nonsense they want. But no, in the Vedic civilization, everyone has controlled senses. The difference is whether they want to get emotionally involved with the senses or not. Because the senses are controlled, that's all. The only difference actually is the emotion. Because the emotion will conclude the senses. Does that make sense? Because sense gratification without emotion doesn't have much happening going for it. Sense gratification connected to emotion, then you get something from it. Right? So that emotion is established by religion. Right? When the religious principles are followed, then the sense gratification gained there is of a higher standard. Because it includes the mind and everything. Right? It includes the intelligence, it includes the ego, right? For your senses, then, if the mind, the intelligence, and ego are also included, it's naturally going to give a better experience than if it's just the senses involved without the mind, the emotions, the intellectual, the ego. Right? Emotions here meaning, you know, actual emotions. Right? How you say it? Dignified emotions. Lust, anger, greed, envy, attachment, these aren't considered emotions. They're emotional, but those aren't what we're talking about. Those are just animal instincts. That's just expansions of anamoy, just sense gratification. Right? But we're talking about, you know, patience, tolerance, humility, you know, respect, gratitude. These are emotions. Does that make sense? So we have to distinguish between the two. Lust, anger, greed, envy, attachment, illusion, madness. These are all part of just the sensual platform. Anamoy, pranamoy. Like that. Religion means the emotions of these good qualities. So whenever I say emotion, I'm talking about the religious platform. I'm not talking about the other. Otherwise somebody gets angry when anyone says something. But that's not emotion. That's just self-centeredness. It seems like an emotion. It kind of acts like one, but it's not. Unless it's based on religious principles, then you can call it an emotion. You know, somebody is doing something wrong against the religious principles. It is our duty to function in that field, to establish it or correct it or some way like that. Then working on that kind of, then that's emotion. Below that is just extension of the senses. It's nothing glorious at all. Just because somebody gets angry at whatever they perceive as right or wrong, who cares? Unless it's something that God says is right or wrong, then you connect it to there, then it has some meaning. That's what Prabhupada says. All emotion, everything except envy, can be connected to the Lord. But experiencing without connecting to the Lord, so what? The dogs get angry also. You walk into their area of town, they bark at you, they come and bite you. So So is that glorious? Is that something special? I mean, any dog does it. Any animal does it. You know, fish, they do it. I mean, they're very territorial. Like that, you know? I mean, so it's just because somebody's territorial and they're very attached to their own thing. So it's just self-centered. It's not. It's nothing to do with religious principles. Does that make some sense? So one has to be able to distinguish between these emotions. In other words, base emotions of the untrained mind and the emotions of a trained person who knows how to focus the mind and engage it properly according to the Lord's direction. So the experience are two completely different things. One is human emotion and one is animal emotion. So the default setting is when you're born is to animal. Right? Then you have to be trained into human. Does that make some sense? Like that. Then it's completely different.
The platform is very different. Right? So that's the whole principle, is that the Lord has created this for the purpose of creating human beings. In other words, these are laws for human beings. Somebody doesn't have to follow them, but then they're taking the position that they're not human.
Prabhupada says, human life begins with Varnashram. If you don't follow Varnashram, then you're actually not human. But the most wonderful thing about devotional service is you don't have to be human to chant Hare Krishna. You know? That point is there. That's why bhakti is so special. Is qualification or no qualification, it still works. But at the same time is when it comes to social interaction, then at some point you have to come to the human platform. You know? You know, unless you're Ivan or Arkinara or Kim Purusha, then it doesn't matter. Because they stay in their own community and they understand that they're animals. So they don't mix with the others. They live in the forest and they know that. In the Bhagavatam you say, we're simple forest dwellers. You know, we live out in the forest and, you know, we have our culture and we follow it, but the Lord's so kind that he also engages us in his service. It's right there in the Bhagavatam. I think that's fifth canto, right? Like that. So then, that's the whole principle. But Varnashram, because Varnashram works when you inquire, why? Who am I? Right? So who am I? Okay, I'm the soul, but I am embodied, so I'm conditioned. How am I conditioned? Right? You're conditioned by, you know, your economic and your economic and social status. And your spiritual platform. Right? So depending upon that, then that's Varnashram. Right? But Varnashram is based on that I am eternal servant of God. I'm the soul. So Varnashram actually only works on that platform. That's Daiva Varnashram. Right? You can have other Varnashram which is not based on that. That's faulty. We're not interested in that. We're only interested in that which is connected. So when devotees say, oh, it's yukta vairagya, it doesn't matter. But yukta vairagya means it's engaged in the Lord's service. So what's the rule on how to engage it? Right? You take a car, you're going to use it in God's service. What's the rules on that? How do you... I mean, you can take the car, get into it, you know, turn it as hard as you can to the left, put it in first gear, floor it, and do a few donuts before you go racing down the road and down the sidewalk, go through the red lights, drive, you know, kitty corner through the gas station. You can do all that, but what'll happen to you? You know? You'll be in trouble, right? The police will catch you, take your license, you'll be fined, you know, so many things. Some countries will take your car. Right? Yeah. Like that. So that's the principle, is that, so how is that following the local customs that are not against God's laws is part of Varnashram, right? Because every place has their particular special customs due to the time, place, and circumstance of those people, right? So those also, if they're not against the laws of God, then they're also to be sanctioned. Right? That's one of the principles. When a king comes in and conquers a new kingdom, He doesn't overturn those laws. He checks them that they're not against the religious principles. If they're not, he sanctions them. He has to. That's the law. Right? Because that's the way they've always done it. You know, just like you say, like I think where it is, maybe it's in Kulu or Manali. They have a very funny custom. Is I think it's they seem to follow there the principle of the Prajapatiya marriage, which means the girl selects the boy. So then they have a unique ritual that the girl will come up and knock on the boy's door, and then I don't know, maybe already everybody knows about it, I don't know, but whatever, she'll knock on the door and she'll give something to the boy. Then as soon as she gives it to the boy, she runs as fast as she can back to her house. And it should be that the boy can catch her before she's able to get into the house. Right? And then when it gets to the house, then the father comes out and invites him in, and then they have the engagement or something like that. So it's not against the religious principles. Right? Because no one else touches that girl. So they're following that, and this boy touches the boy. So they always have in the Vedic, every community has their few little rules that breaks the ice between the boy and girl touching each other. You know, like they do things with coconuts, they do all kinds of stupid things like that, you know. You put a coconut there, and then the boy and girl try to, you know, pull it apart, or you have a, what do you call it? They have a little pot, and they put inside water, and then they put some, I think, miter or something to make it cloudy so you can't see. And then they'll drop, you know, like a gold ring or a bangle in there. And then the idea is whoever can get that first, they have control of the money in the house. So that one you see the most kind of like enthusiastic endeavors for. Because you can't see, because they'll put it in and this and that. So then they're in there, and it's quite big, so there's a lot of room. So in that, then they'll be touching and this and that. So all it is just to break the ice, and then the boys and girls side of the family are there. So then it creates some laughter and that, and so then they all get to know each other. So they're not against religious principles, because it's only the boy touching the girl, that's it. No one else is touching her. And it's only after it's approved. Right? Means here then the father will give the girl away. He approves of it. So it's most likely the girl's already told the father, I would like to marry this boy. He's approved. Then she'll go to knock on his door. You understand? So that's a local custom. Other places, you never hear of that. You never hear of the girl running around and the guy chasing. So that means that, you know, it means, but that would work there because these are mountain people. So the girls there will be tough, right? The streams are always down, your hills are up. So that means they're carrying water up and down the hills. So they're tough girls. So then it's a fun, you know. I'm not sure what happens if she gets home first and he doesn't make it. Then I can't remember. They said something, but, you know, whatever it is. But it's not against the principles. So the king, who would then capture that kingdom, would authorize those laws. And that would be, they have to do it that way. That's your customs, you have to do it that way. Just like Prabhupada was saying that, I'm not sure it was in their company, or he just gave example of one company. The company was basically all Hindus. And the company, I don't know if it was bought by a Muslim, or a Muslim supervisor was made the head of that company. It was probably, maybe it was a British company, and they appointed a Muslim supervisor. And he was quite, you know, in those days, the Muslims and the Hindus weren't on the greatest of terms, right? Oh. So then he came in and he called all the workers. And he said, because they were all wearing tilak, he says, you know, because this is, you know, tomorrow you all come, you can't wear tilak. You know? So and then the next day, then the Muslim supervisor called all of the workers there, and he saw none of them were wearing tilak except one guy. And he called him and says, "Didn't you hear the rule? No tilak." And he pointed out and says, "I always wear tilak. This is my determination. You know, it's our tradition. We wear tilak." And he says, "And it doesn't matter. It means you don't like, I'll stop working here, but I'm wearing my tilak." And then the guy announced, "Okay. He can wear his tilak, but if I catch any one of you others wearing tilak, you'll be fired." He says, because he believes in his religion and all you other guys don't. Like that. So that's the principle, is that
If the king sees it, it's all, then it's the rule. You have to follow it. It's your tradition. May not be their tradition, but it's your tradition. You have to follow it. Otherwise, loss of tradition is considered bad. That was Arjuna's whole point in the beginning of Gita. Losing of traditions socially is the worst thing that can happen. Right? But he wasn't connecting it to Krishna. So that's the point. Okay, does this make some sense? Yeah. Okay, so now Bhrigu then starts. Now from now on, for the rest until the end of the 12th chapter, Bhrigu will be speaking. Then that great sage Bhrigu, being thus addressed by Manu, here Manu meaning Brahma, spoke, pleased in his heart, to all the sages, listen. Right? So he's pleased in his heart because he's been given his order by his father. Here are sages that are worthy of speaking to. Right? So under order, higher authority, he's speaking to a qualified audience, valuable knowledge. Then he's pleased at heart. Right? So that's the whole point, is you have knowledge shouldn't be given to someone who is not interested. So here's interested people, and it's been authorized, so therefore he's very happy. So now the next is, mind performs the work of creation by modifying itself. Right? 1A24. At the end of that day and night, he who is asleep awakes, and after awaking, creates mind, which is both real and unreal. Right? It means the mind itself is an element, so it's real. Right? But what mind creates, both is real, it means it exists, but how you perceive it, that may or may not be real. Right? Like we have this table here. It's real, it exists, but now how you perceive that, that may or may not be real. So the only way to judge if it's real is if it's connected to the sacred law. Right? Unless you connect it to God's direction, that's the only way you know it's real. Then the element you're dealing with is real, and how you perceive it is real. Otherwise, it's unreal. You know, that is the conclusion. Like that. Your perception, if it's not in line with God's direction, it's unreal. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You line up millions of people with the same opinion. A falsity doesn't become a truth because a million people say it is. And if one qualified, educated person says something's a truth, even though everybody else says it's false, it's still true. So popular opinion does not come into as a question. Popular opinion is only used to know how to present something. The truth is still presented. You never see Prabhupada compromise in saying Krishna is God. Right? Or that God is the creator. You know, if they don't understand specific that God has name for all these things, he'll mention he does, but he'll stick just more to the God part. Right? If you're speaking to Christians, you just talk about God. Like that. Because generally they don't think in that term, so you don't get that high. But the principle is you speak about God, but he never compromised that. Right? Even devotees who do something wrong socially, he'd still support the devotees. Because devotees are still, they're better than everyone else. They're accepting God and trying to do everything for God. Though, because they're conditioned, they make mistakes. They shouldn't do it. It's wrong. But the point is they're trying. Right? You know, something may happen. And like it's pointed out, a bad person may sometimes come in contract with something virtuous, but in his heart, he's only doing it for his bad motives. Right? For a virtuous person may sometimes get involved in something they shouldn't get involved in, but their determination is still virtuous. Right? So therefore, then they're always, he would always support the devotees. So to not support the devotees and think that the karmis are better, then that's not so good. Because what better? They're nice for their own purposes. they're smart enough to know that if I'm nice, people will react with me nice. So it's the best way to make the material nature work. They want to get the most out of it, so therefore they're nice. But still, that's not good enough. It has to be connected to Krishna. They're still thieves. Right? It's God's creation. You acknowledge God and behave properly, then that's the best. Right? But if you don't acknowledge God, then what's the use? They're all thieves. So you have a nice thief and you have an unnice thief, right? You have your sophisticated person who's a thief, and you have your street pickpocket. But what's the difference? They're both thieves. Like that. So in the thieves' world, yes. Then maybe the more sophisticated guys, then they're more respected, right? Because they got on the suit and they got the fedora on and all that kind of stuff. So they're more respected. But the point is they're still all thieves, right? So there, it doesn't matter. But someone is God conscious. That's special. Now within those who are God conscious and follow etiquette, that's the best. They're nicely situated. They're stable in their devotional service. Those who don't follow etiquette will be unstable in their devotional service. So naturally stable devotional service is considered better than unstable, right? Because the devotional service is defined as that which is constant. So that means they're sometimes situated in devotional service. But those who are stable, who follow the etiquette, are always established. Does that make some sense? Okay. So that's why the etiquette's so important. Mind impelled by Brahma's desire to create, Brahman's desire to create, performs the work of creation by modifying itself. Thence ether is produced. They declare that sound is the quality of the latter. And that sound is the quality of ether, right? So each one will spring from the other, right? From mind, then that transforms by adding ego, and you get ether with sound. Then you add ego again, then you get the next. Right? But from ether modifying itself springs the pure, powerful wind, the vehicle of all perfumes. It is held to possess the quality of touch. Right? You get smell out of it, and touch. Next, from wind modifying itself proceeds the brilliant light, which illuminates and dispels darkness. That is declared to possess the quality of color. And from light modifying itself is produced water, possessing the quality of taste. From water, earth, which has the quality of smell. Such is the creation in the beginning. The age of the gods, or 12,000 of their years, being multiplied by 71, constitutes what is here named the period of Amanu, Manvantar. The Manvantars, the creations and destructions of the world, are numberless. Sporting, as it were, Brahman repeats this again and again. So here Brahman always means Vishnu. Because this text is being written for everybody. So even the impersonalists and the Karmakandis, everyone follows this. So if you say Brahman, they'll all accept that. But we know Brahman means Krishna. He's the Para Brahman, the Supreme Brahman. Like that. So we have no problem. It's just the language. It's all using, in other words, where you don't want it to be, people cannot accept it, then you use secondary names of God. And where they can, then you use the primary. Right? So amongst devotees and, the pious, they're more favorable, then you use the primary names, because then everyone benefits. But where they don't, you use the secondary names. So Brahman, God, the Supreme, the Controller, all these different things like that. Does that make some sense? So here, then, we've shown here is that the Lord, when He recreates, then all these things, then mind, all these things are done, and then from that then comes all living entities. I'm going to come up a little bit. Should be missing a few verses here. missing the verses. Well, maybe we'll come across it later. It's supposed to be that everything's created out of those five in the mind. We're missing. Yeah, we're missing a verse here. There's a verse in here that means that all created beings are made out of these five elements plus the mind. Like that. That there's somehow or another that's not in here. Yeah, so that's the whole point, is that everybody's created out of these things, yes. Mm-hmm. Means
because they feel like they have the same time that we do.
Yeah, well, it's just like you and an ant. Ants live by our calculation 2 weeks, but in their experience is 100 years. Every living entity, their experience in life is 100 years.
So what do they experience that is so much more than we experience?
No, it's just a matter of their experiences over a longer period of time. Otherwise, what they experience is no different. Means the affection that you will feel for your friends is no different than the dog feels for their friends. You know, a human mother, her affection for a child and what the animal feels for the child is no different. The attachment's the same. Unless it's, you elevate it to religious principles, there's no difference.
It just lasts longer, but we don't realize it dies.
It's just like if you took ants as normal and you live longer than the ant, then how would you see it? Mm-hmm. The ant lives 2 weeks, but in their experience they live 100 years. It's 100 years in their time. Mm-hmm. So then what's the difference between your life experience and their life experience? You experience 100 years, they experience 100 years. But their 100 years last 2 weeks, your 100 years lasts our 100 years.
Well, I guess that's why I could never understand through this example, because they are animals and they are humans. So it's slightly different.
What's the difference? What's the difference? Eating, sleeping, mating, defending, what's the difference?
Yeah, on that level, yeah. But they don't reflect, they don't think in terms of present, past, and future.
Are you sure? It means they always give the example of the ant is busy putting things away. It's just like if you see ants climbing up the wall carrying their eggs, you know there's going to be a rain. So they know future. Yeah. Like that.
But I mean, they don't question anything.
No, they're very submissive. They're very loyal. Yeah, I mean, he's a big ant standing at the door of the cave. He's questioning, what are you doing there? You know, why is your finger close to the opening of our anthill here? And if you get too close, then he, you know, since you didn't give him an answer in language he understood, then you get bit. They don't question what's beyond eating, sleeping, and maybe defending, but they question. Prabhupada says, question and answer. He said the birds in the morning and evening, they're all going chirp, 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 like this. You hear, he says question and answer. Like you see in these beehives. If you watch them really carefully, you'll see a bee fly in, and then they get in and they start going around in this figure eight circle, wagging their tail and going around like that. From that, they tell the other bees which direction and how much pollen is there. And then that many then fly off. So it's all question and answer. They're all eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. They get right into it.
Some of the ants, you see them walking in one lane. Some of the ants come in the opposite direction. They touch it.
Yeah. They're always, when they're going, they're touching and like that. So they're only touched to find out what's going on. So they have their way of communicating. So that's no different. That's the whole point, is a human being feels he's special because
he's on the 87th floor of some, you know, fancy hotel in a you know, king-size bed with the satin sheets, and he thinks his sex is better than the dog in the street. There's no difference. The dog, the experience of the dog and the experience of the human is exactly the same. There is not within their mind the physical experience any difference. There's no difference. That's the thing. Is the human thinks they're special, but they're not. The only thing that makes them special is if they acquire higher than eating, sleeping, mating, defending. When they acquire who am I, who that makes a difference. What has that got to do with time?
The
That's fortune.
Of consciousness?
Yes, but what has that got to do with time? Just like you have Markandeya Rishi and you have Parasara Muni. So Markandeya, he is the oldest sage in the universe. He's Chiranjeev. He'll live as long as Brahma. Like that. I think he's limited as Brahma's lifetime. It may be it doesn't even matter, but at least it doesn't matter the destruction at Brahma's end of the night. You know, so many times he gets stuck and he's out there in the ocean, the palai floating around, and he sees a baby boy going by and a leaf sucking his toe, and you know, and he looks at him, and then the boy sucks him up inside him, and you know, all kinds of stuff. He has a wild time. So he's been there since the beginning. And so then, if there's a group of sages and he's there, because he's the eldest, he always speaks. So one day he was sitting and speaking to all these great sages. And then suddenly, you know, his eyes light up and he stands up. You know, because he sees somebody coming. So then all the sages that are there, Markandeya, I mean, who's bigger than him? Maybe a Narad Muni, maybe Lord Brahma's coming. But other than that, he's respected by everybody. So they other sages stand up also and turn around expecting to see, you know, Narad or Brahma or Lord Vishnu himself or like that. They turn around and they see this little 9-year-old boy. Brahmin boy, the little dinky boy. It's kind of like, okay. Then Markandeya says, you know, I invite him, please, you come and sit and speak. You know, we all want to hear from you. And so the boy, he complains, says, I'm a little boy, I'm only 9 years old. Says, you're Markandeya Rishi, you're Chiranjeev, you've been here since time immemorial. So you're the one who has the experience and all that. And he says, no. In your 9 years of life, you've had more moments of consciousness of God than I have in my long life. So therefore, you're older than me. So it's not a matter of time. Does that make some sense?
Mm-hmm.
Like that. The point is that for them, their day is just longer. Like that. It means the time that it goes from our morning to evening for us is one day. But for an ant, that actually will be many years. The experience that we would get over many years, they get in one of our days. Right? And then you have bugs that last one night. You know, one's around the bulb in the at night, and then the next morning they're on the ground dead. So that means their 100 years happens in one of our nights. You know, in that whole time as they grow up and they're, you know, young and sporting and buzzing around, and then they find themselves their eternal life, you know, soulmate, and then they have their little bug offsprings, and then, you know, they get old, and in the morning they're on the floor and the guy comes and sweeps them away, right? So it all happens in one, but they get the same experience. So the demigods means one of our years is for them one day and is 24 hours. That's all. The sun, the way it moves because of the local mountains, then we see it every day and they see it over 6 months, light and 6 months dark. Like when you get up to the north of the earth, then it starts to turn into their time. That's why people that live up there go nuts, because it's not our time, it's their time.
Yeah.
You go up to the north. Right? It means, you know, you get right up to the Arctic Circle.
Yeah.
It's 6 months day, 6 months night. So it's just a matter of how the mountains are positioned that you see the sun as we do in a 24-hour cycle, or you see it in a 6-month cycle. Like that. It's just the position of the planets. So the Loka mountains, they somehow or another, I understand, they have something to do with it. How they move and stuff like that, and the sun, the way it goes. Because the sun moves at a certain level, and then it slowly comes up. As it goes Uttarayana, it goes up. Mm-hmm. And when it comes up, then it rises for them, and then it goes back down, and then so we see it every day, right? Because we're below it here. But then it's blocked by the mountains. So only when it rises above a certain thing, then they see it as day, and then they see it as night. So that's how it works for them. And so there one day, we've gone through a lot, you know. Yeah, well, it means it would be 360 of our years to be one of their years. You know, times 100. So that means 3,600 of our years is 100 years for them. Right? Is it? Did I calculate right? No. No, 365 is 1 year.
Yeah,
so it's like that. So therefore, this is calculated by ages of the demigods. You know. Because also then, depending upon which planet they're on, they'll live longer or less, so then they have also different calculations. Like for Brahma in his court, you know, it's like that, was it? That story of Revati. Revati's father wanted to marry her because she was very qualified, couldn't find anyone, wasn't quite sure, so he went up to Brahma's court. At the time, Brahma was listening to some music recital and all that, and then, you know, so they waited, and when Brahma was finished, then he said to him, "How may I help you?" He says, "You know, I'd like to get my daughter married, and I'm not sure who would be the qualified person, so please could you give us an idea?" He says, "Well, now all the kings that you were thinking of, they're all dead and gone. But if you go back to Earth now, then there's a very qualified person." He said, "Balaram is there." So then they went back, and because they were from a previous age, and she was a little bit big. So then I'm not sure how it was arranged, but whatever it is, she was made to be Balaram's size, and then they were married.
So he took his plow and pulled her down.
Yeah? Oh, okay. Okay. Show who's boss, right? Okay. Does that make some sense? It's getting better. But the point is it's just longer.
My question is, is it because they have a more refined sense of perception?
Oh, you were saying, why is it like that? Means the problem is mechanically, how is their day longer? Or the question is why would their day be longer?
Yes, something like that.
How what?
What is it filled with? That long time. Hmm?
Well, what do you fill your 24 hours with?
Well, I'm very primary and basic.
My point is you get up in the morning, you take your bath, you have your sadhana, you go to the day, so that's what it happens for them. Just, you know, their bath takes, you know, many of your, you know, many
months.
Weeks would go by for them to take the bath, that's all. Because their time works different. Just like, that's what I say, the ant goes through. It's just like you take a dog, one of our years is 10 years for them, like that. So what happens in our year, the experience for the dog, it happens as 10 years.
It's still a dog, like goes to sleep at night, and, you know, for him a day and a night is the same length as you.
Yeah, but the experience is he gets more out of it. But there, they're working on a different time frame. 6 months is their night, and 6 months is their day.
They grow faster, and they have less memory.
Yeah, so the point is they live 100 years, but their 100 years is stretched over a longer period of time.
Because it's a different time.
Yeah. So just does that make some sense there?
I remember a science fiction movie a long time ago. The person went on another. He went in a spaceship, which brought him beyond time. And then he came out of it and he was still in the same frame, although he came out of it. And then he was seeing people move really slowly, very, very, very slowly. He was moving normally. So maybe it's something like that. It's like, you know, he was seeing his wife put on the lipstick and she was stuck in front of the mirror for him. Like,
isn't that normal? You probably give another example. That was probably but see, you have to be really, really careful about these scientific movies. It's just like this. You have okay. Here's the thing. The guy comes from the future into the past, right? To save a woman who he has sex with, who gives birth to himself. Right? It just doesn't work. It's just they put anything together in the mind. They're always doing this. They always got to go into the past to save themselves in the future. They wouldn't exist. But if they're there in the future, it means they already exist. You don't have to go back into the past to save yourself. You know, so it's like you're already there. You know, so it's they play around with these stupid things because they don't have any standards, so they just dream up the weirdest stuff. You know, right? So don't get bewildered about that. You know, these are just the point is like this: is they have ads to sell, right? And those ads only sell if the program people like to watch. And since they got to put on the program every week, they got to come up with something to intrigue you that you're going to watch that program as opposed to, you know, the variety show or something. You know, does that make some sense? So that's the whole point. It's just they dream these things up. You know, whether it's true, it's based on principles that they've seen. You know, like that. It means they've seen their wife take forever to put on the makeup, so then they just extend that there, right? They could have used something else, you know. They could have used the kid on the skateboard, you know, if he's there in the middle of the street for so long. But they don't use that one. Oh, they use that one also. Okay. Like that. No, I think it was a truck, right? About going to run over the person, and then he has to tie something up so the wheel breaks the car, right? Isn't it that one? And then the person gets saved and all that. Like that. So those things are. Does that make some sense? Is that don't base it on that. Point is they have their day, and their life goes like that. So when you go to their place, it functions like that. When they come here, then they move at our speed. You know, they take our size, move at our speed, and everything like that. When they go back to their place, they take their size and move at their speed. So that's how time works, because time is Krishna. So the question is just Krishna creates it like that? It means this whole thing is only 3/4 of a second for Mahavishnu. When he breathes in and breathes out, then... Does that make sense?
According to Prabhupada, the universe would come since he started his own... Because he saw Brahma, he saw Maradamuni and...
Yeah, he said they would come to. I think it was really funny to watch the Malechas chanting and dancing. It was quite fun for them. You know, one, it's nice that you've got them chanting and dancing. But two, it's just also the way they chant and dance. It's kind of, you know, it's like you have a. What do you call it? What's that called? You know, it's like when they do kirtan, it's like a mosh pit. You know, they get in there and kill each other and stuff like that. So for them, it's fun. You know. Like you always hear in the Shastras, you know, very, you know, dignified, lordly kind of dancing, very slow and their hands up and moving and all these things. They're not there jumping up and down and smashing into each other and doing all these weirdo things and stuff like that. You know? So for them it's fun to come and watch, you know, watch the Malechas dance. And, you know, but point is they're dancing and it's transcendental. So that's the only reason they're there, because it is transcendental, but it's kind of fun watching. You know, it's just like we'll sometimes watch the kids dance because they'll dance differently than adults. So it's fun to watch them dance. They do all kinds of funny, crazy things like that. So for them, when they come and watch the Malechas dance, yeah, it's fun. Like that.
So when they come here, then they move at our speed. And when they go there, they move at their speed. Like that. It's just like when you talk to a kid, then you use their, you use language they can understand. When you talk to an adult, you use language they understand. You know, a kid's attention spans in, you know, a couple of seconds, so then you get it by in a few seconds, you know, give something that they can understand. You know, talk about something to eat or something, you know, it always catches their attention. And for an adult, you might discuss something for hours. You can't do that with the kids. You know, so the kids are thinking, you know, what are you doing? Talking for 3 hours on the same subject, you know? You know, like that, you know? That makes some sense?
Okay. Okay, so then we have the whole, in other words, the create, okay, so then this section here, then the point is that everything is just actually a modification of the mind, right? It's all coming from mind. So mind is the essential element that you're trying to catch. And mind is where the seat of what is accepting and rejecting. So all duality is seen, experienced in the mind. Right? And so accepting what is favorable and rejecting what is unfavorable, that's the field. So that's why here, the whole point that it's all seen in relationship to the mind. Right? That's the important element. In other words, if the mind accepts it, it works. If it doesn't accept it, it won't function. What your mind accepts is what you do. What your mind doesn't accept, you don't do. Like that. So at least in principle, you have to accept it. Maybe detail, it complains about. Right? Like we accept the principle of I'm going to follow the sadhana. Because we know that I'm going to follow spiritual life. So that means I have to practice sadhana. So the mind's accepted that, but it may or may not like doing chanting at this time or that time or going to the Arctic or, you know, like that. You know, so then you have to convince it. But in general, it has accepted. That's why you can convince. But what it accepts is what you do, and what it doesn't accept is what you don't do. It's very, very simple like that.
I came across one verse in Srimad Bhagavatam, I think it's in the third chapter, and it said that whatever mind creates, whatever is created in the mind exists somewhere in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So that means mind cannot create anything by own. So everything was created by the God.
Yeah,
already.
It means it can put things together. But everything you talk about is there in the universe. It exists in the universe.
So that means all such crazy things which come to the mind.
It's all somewhere there in your experience. How you put it together, like Prabhupada says, you see gold and you see a mountain, then at night in a dream you see a golden mountain.
Mm-hmm.
But gold exists, mountains exist.
Mm-hmm.
Golden mountain may or may not exist.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like you see men, you see wolves, and you have werewolves, but they don't exist. You know what I'm saying?
Oh.
Yeah. Prabhupada made that point. They're not a species of life.
So you mentioned those scientific fictions means basically.
Yeah, it means they've seen that.
Mm.
You know, they've seen that, you know, there's fast and there's slow and stuff like that, and people do these things and they put it together, and you know, it's intriguing. It means because you have the same field and you have to do something with it. Mm. You know what I'm saying? The devotees, they deal with the same field, but because they're not interested in the field, therefore, they by dealing with it, they get bored of the field. Right? Understand? Means material life is boring. Right? Because it's repetitive. There's nothing new. There's nothing fresh. It's repetitive. So anything that always repeats gets boring. But if that's all you have, then you'll try to find finer and finer nuances within it to make some variety. But for the devotee, because they're not interested in perfecting the material existence, and that's going to be their happiness. Therefore, then when that repetition brings to the point of boredom or losing interest in it, then they drop it and they switch to spiritual. right? Same time is because you have to perform an activity. The activity is still performed, but only for the purpose of pleasing Krishna. Otherwise, it itself is not what you're doing to get your pleasure. You know what I'm saying? Like that. So that way, then they extricate themselves out of the material energy. So the point is, the materialist has to find more and more ways to point out that everything's still fine. You know, it's a complete disaster. Everything's falling apart. Everything's finished. The culture's been destroyed. You know, no one's left, but still there's still a boy and girl and there's some romance and life goes on. Right? You'll always see it has to end that way. Then that inspires that, yes, it's still okay. I still have a reason to live because, you know, in the movie, the boy and girl got together. So it inspires me to carry on.
On the case of like neophyte devotee, so he, although he's maybe not convinced in the beginning, so he just continues to have doubts in the spiritual path, so he can try for a while, but finally he comes to the same realization, so he drops it.
Mm-hmm.
So that means like the process works, just question of time.
Yeah, it's just time. It means if one has that faith, means at least intellectually you have to have the faith, right? It means that the mind values logic, you know, then, and clear answers, means conclusion. Then, okay, it's a clear answer. I don't realize it, but it makes sense. So therefore, I'll do it for a while. It's just like the doctor tells you, follow this diet and take this medicine. You haven't seen it, but because you have faith in the principle of the doctor knows what he's talking about, and the principle in diets and in medicines. So therefore, you follow it, even though it's intellectual, and then you get the result. When you get the result, then you can very clearly tell people, yeah, this is a good doctor, a good medicine, a good diet, or like that. Then you have no problem. Mm-hmm. But until that time, then it's a bit intellectual. You know? But at the same time, is because we're dealing with spiritual, therefore it's still transcendental. Right? You're still getting transcendental benefit. Like that. But the more you're convinced, the more you get. Right? The more you're convinced, the more you can convince others. So what you have seen, that you can speak very strongly on. Right? So that's the point. What you're convinced about in Krishna consciousness, speak on that. Even if it's just this food is great, you know, you're not going to get better food than this, right? You talk on that, you know, and you'll convince people. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So end here.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki. Okay. The ontological position.
What that means is, he was the Gandhava.
Uh-huh.
Because he's always an eternal spaceman. He's only one knowing. Before he was the Gandhava, what was his position before? He became the maidservant son after the result of the curse, and he went through the process of becoming the Gandhava.
Who's that?
Together.
Oh, okay. Okay, so if you can keep these all up here, and then as we go, then as we finish this section, then we'll give out the next section.
Mm-hmm.
That way, then we don't. Or you can just put them all down and get them all and make them all done.
Mm-hmm. So we can add extra pages.
Yeah. What I can see is that I took out the whole detail and time here, and then Nakaji asked a question. And we're missing a verse on how all living entities are created out of mind in these five elements. So it seems that. You have to put in some. see, as Narad Muni's Narad Muni, then at the very end of the last creation, there's some pastime came up where there was some pride about his brahmacharya. And then in a discussion with Brahma, then I'm not sure how it worked out, but then whether it's a curse or what happened, then Brahma made him into that Gandharva. Right? And then the Gandharva then naturally then became the maidservant. That maidservant was just at the very end of the day. So you can see the Gandharva and the maidservant just in the last moments of the last day of Brahma. Then disillusion is there. Then he appears again as Narad Muni. So it's just for a very short time. So it's just a pastime to show the principle of how it works. Because he would have had to have been Narad Muni before to be that Gandharva. Right? Is because of control of the senses, then sense objects are offered. To that degree your senses are controlled, to that degree you have sense gratification. Now you look at it, what kind of sense control you have to have that you have one Gandharva, one man, and he can keep 50 Gandharva women, right? These aren't ordinary women, these are Gandharva women. Anybody in the universe is happy to have them around. But he's keeping 50 of them following him, and they're perfectly mesmerized by him. So that means the amount of brahmacharya austerity that had to have been performed had to be immense. Right? You see that people have trouble keeping one woman impressed, let alone 50 at the same time. Right? He's able to fully entertain 50 women consistently, day in, day out. That's Shakti. So only because he was Narad Muni, is a brahmachari, then that would be there. Right? Then, only because he's Narad Muni, then born as a maidservant's son, by taking Vishad once of the Mahabhagavatas, then he himself turned into one. So it's just a pastime because you don't need to know all this stuff before. It's there in another Purana. It's described. That whole thing is, I forget what it was, but it was something to do. He was proud of his brahmacharya and he made some comments. So then Brahma, so then he made him into the Gandharva. Okay, proud of being the brahmacharya. Okay, you go hang out with 50 Gandharva ladies and see what trouble that gets you into, you know. Because he's always inquiring and this and that into all the stories in the Shastras and the Puranas where women describe the qualities of women, means the inside qualities, means what they know about and the men don't know about, is generally Narad Muni inquiring from one of the prominent women in the universe. Like that. And there he'll bump into a Rumba going somewhere. And then he'll ask her, please describe me the nature of women. And she'll say, no, it says this would be, how do you say, disloyal to the species, right? Like that. And so then he says, no, but truth can always be spoken. She says, oh, okay, you want to hear it? Then she starts into it, and like, ooh, okay. You know? Then another time he's asking Parvati. Like that. So like this. Many times he's inquiring these things and this and that, and moving around everywhere. So just this time somehow another he got himself in trouble with Brahma. And so then he became a Gandharva, and then from that then he fell down. But that's not described by, because only how much of the story is necessary is described in the one place. Right? Like the purpose is Vidura getting cursed. Yamaraj cursed as Vidura. So that means is the part of the story that Mandukya Muni is impaled on the stake. So only that much of the story is told. Because that's all that's necessary. Right? But then you've also heard of that story of where the chaste wife stopped the sun from rising because her husband was cursed to die before the sun came up. Right? You've heard that story. Okay. That story, it's all the same story. That's when Mandukya Muni was impaled on the stake. Then during that time, then
than that woman who stopped the sun. She was carrying her husband by, and he was a leper and he didn't smell really great. And so Mandukya Muni thought he was in his ashram still, and that the demons were coming, you know, with their, you know, regular barrage of stool and urine and pus and all these kind of things. And they were raining it on his ashram. So he cursed whoever was doing that, making his ashram smell bad, to die before the sun came up. He didn't know that he wasn't in his ashram. So then she said, okay, then the sun doesn't come up. And because of her chastity, she had the power to stop the sun. So it's still the same story, but it's told in a different Purana. Right? And then you may have heard of the story about the wife who, the husband was a leper, wanted to visit this big name prostitute. So the wife went to that prostitute and said, can you, you know, take care, you know, can my husband come and visit you? You know, she said, my rates are really high, you know. And she says, we don't have any money, but, you know, I can do menial service and assist you for however long it takes, and then when you feel satisfied that it's paid, then you can bring it for the night. So that prostitute was so impressed with this, you know, determination and focus and chastity of this wife, she said, you know, you don't have to work, you just bring the guy. So when he brought, then the lady, you know, made arrangements, went, cooked all kinds of nice things, took her bath nicely, then brought all the prasad, or whatever she made, whatever, and every preparation was double. One was in a gold bowl, and one was in an iron bowl. So when the leper saw all this, and he figured it out, he says, why you have these two? Why every preparation is doubled? One in a gold bowl, one in his iron bowl. And so the prostitute says, well, that's what you want. That's, you know, your mood. He says, my mood? Why? I never said anything about this. He says, yeah. He says, it's the same taste, right? He says, it's the same thing, yes. He says, but you want to taste it in the iron bowl, and you want to taste it in the gold bowl. He says, no, I just need to taste one. He says, the taste of associating with a woman is the same, no matter who it is. You have your wife, but you're considering her to be the iron bowl, and you consider me the gold bowl. But the taste you're going to get by contacting a woman is the same. So we've heard of all these three stories, but that's one story. Right? So that's the same lady, then after that, then she's carrying her husband back home, and then the whole thing with Mandukya Muni. But all these stories are in three different places. Because you only tell how much of the story is important for that. Yeah, what you're trying to get across. Because all the stories are interconnected. You know what I'm saying? They're all interconnected. So that's the thing, is from one story you get all the others. You practically can start anywhere at one story, and from that you can practically get all the other stories. You take any one story of Mahabharata to explain it, you have to have basically all the other stories. You know, it's just like, what do you call it? Vinata and Kadru, their sons. Right? But then to do that, then you also have to know about the Prajapatis, and then Daksha, and then his daughters, and how he gave, I think, 13 or 26 to Kasyapa. Thirteen. Like that. So Kadru and Vinata are two of them. Right? And Vamana is Aditi. So Garuda and Garuda is actually the brother of Vishnu. We just think of him as servant, but actually he's the brother. They have the same father. You know? So then from this you can get into all those stories. And then at the same time is that why there's enmity between them was over that over a bet on whether Uchaisrava's tail is white or black. Right? So then who is Uchaisrava? So then that gets to the whole churning of the milk ocean. Right? And the churning of the milk ocean, but then in there there's the curse there, and then Vasuki is used around the mountain as the rope. So because Brahma was pleased with him, then he got the benediction that only the bad snakes would be killed in the snake sacrifice at Janamejaya, being cursed by their mother. Right? And so then in that, to save them, that snake sacrifice has to be stopped by Astika, who is the son of then
Vasuki's sister, whose name is Jarakaru, with Jarakaru. Right? Then you have to have this whole story of Jarakaru in that. Then you have to, Janamejaya, why would he even have the snake sacrifice? That's because he's inspired by Udalaka. Right? That this Takshika makes trouble. Because Udalaka went to get the earrings of the king's wife, the queen, to give to his guru's wife for his dakshin, but Takshika stole them. And not only that, then I think someone else, then Takshika gave trouble to one of the descendants of Bhrigu, like that. So between these two Brahmins complaining and all that, you know. So then you can just see it's all you can't. So you just want to get a point across, you only tell that part of the story, and you tell just that much that it's good. If you think about it, then you ask. It's like they told, ask. We hear about Vritrasura before we hear about Chitraketu. You hear the story of Vritrasura, and then afterwards you think, how is it this demon is actually more God-conscious and actually more dutiful and pious, though he's a demon, than Indra, the king of heaven, who is the most pious of all the demigods. So then you have to tell the whole story of Chitraketu. You know, so it just, they come up. So that which is favorable for the particular purpose of the work, those stories are told. Because the Bhagavad is unlimited, the Pancharatra is unlimited, the Dharma Shastra is unlimited, every one of them is unlimited. So particularly to get it across, then those stories and that would do it the best are gotten across. You know, like for Bhagavatam, then you tell the story of when Parikit is a Paramahamsa, right? So he's cursed. He gives up his kingdom. He goes down, sits next to the Ganga, and he hears about Bhagavatam. And when Takshika comes, and he comes, and who cares, right? Because there it's a literature for Paramahamsas. But in other times, when it's not, when Swayam Krishna is there. So then the whole pastime is slightly different. Is that then he's taking the mood of the king, so therefore he builds a palace. He builds this fort that's on one pillar that has one door entrance. You can't get into the palace except through that door, and that's guarded. Yeah. But still, Takshika gets in on a basket of fruit brought by his own snake brothers, you know, transforming themselves into the form of Brahmins. Right? So therefore he's taking the thing of, you know, he's afraid of that. So he's taking more the mood of the king. The other one is taking the mood of the devotee. So because it's Mahabharata is to establish religious principles, and in that God consciousness, therefore that story is, that one you would take you would prefer the one of him building the palace. But if your point is that the devotees are completely dependent on the Lord, they don't care for all these things, then you take the Bhagavatam. They're both correct, it's just different yugas. So many times you'll see that there'll be differences there, depending upon what is their purpose. Like that? So that's kalpa beta. Kalpa beta. Beta means difference in kalpa. Different kalpas. You know, like in Bhagavatam you have Sweta Varaha, who is white, and you also have the Varaha who is red. So both are mentioned in the lists of avatars. Like that. So whenever is this particular cycle of that incarnation, it's always coming. You know, so probably every Dwapara Yuga, you have Krishna coming and the Pandavas. But depending upon what the mood is, then it'll be slightly different. You know, every time Ramachandra comes, and that's what's fun for Jambavan, because Jambavan is Chiranjeev. So when they're building going to go to Lanka, this time they built a bridge. So then he's in ecstasy, and he's telling about how this time Ramachandra went like this, and in that time Yuga he went like that, and then this time he went like this, and he's telling all about all the other times and how he came. You know, like we know, Nrisimhadev comes in. Comes out of the pillar, but sometimes he comes in the front gate. You know, here he kills Hiranyakashipu, then his army. But when he comes in the front gate, he first kills the army, then he kills Hiranyakashipu. You know, now he's kind of more smaller, so then he fights with him inside. You know, but the other one, he comes so big. You know,
means one of them, when he splits them in half, then he can't find the demon. He thought he escaped. So he's looking all around and he's getting really, really in anxiety that the demon's got away. And then when he shakes his hand, then he sees, you know, one bit comes out from one nail and one bit comes from the other nail. He's just so big, he just got caught under his nails when he cut him in half. So like that, there's always, but depending upon what is the purpose that you want to bring out, you know, therefore then you'll quote that particular pastime. So that the literature is unlimited. So that's why Vyasadeva compiles an amount that we can grasp and deal with. But otherwise, on the heavenly planets, the Mahabharata is huge, huge. This is only a portion of it. It was written as it was conceived of as 600,000 shlokas. But when it was actually recited and taught, it was only taught as 100,000. Right? And the heavenly planets is even bigger than that. Because the Bharata simply means the history of India. So that means anything from the creation, you know, down to that time at the end of Dwapara Yuga, is all the Bharata. Right? So that means, you know, now we're in the 51st year of Lord Brahma's lifetime. Right? We're in the 28th, we're in the 7th Manu. Right? So 7, that means already 71 times 6 yugas have gone by. Then in this 7th Manu, we're in the 28th yuga cycle. Right? 28 out of 71. So how many stories there are? So only those are selected that are important. So therefore, conversations are selected. Who's talking to who? So here, it's Bhrigu speaking to the sages on Dharmashastra. The same knowledge is spoken by Narad Muni to Yudhishthir in the Bhagavatam. But because it's a Paramahamsa speaking to another, basically, Paramahamsa, you know, therefore, the emphasis out of 5 chapters on Varnashram, only two of them basically deal with what we would call Varnashram. The other 3 deal more with just the whole mentality of the Paramahamsa and the whole thing. Like, Dharmashastra infers the Paramahamsa. Like that. But Bhagavatam then specifically brings that out. Does that make sense? So it's the same knowledge, because he said he spoke it to all 10 of his sons. Narad's one of them. So he said, here, Bhrigu will tell you. Because it was the sages, what they wanted to hear, then Bhrigu would tell, because he would bring out those aspects for them. Right? And that would become Dharmashastra. But when Narad Muni speaks Dharmashastra, it's actually transcendental knowledge. Right? Like that. So that's how the scriptures work. Okay. Jai Ho. Okay.